Hello there, viewers. In this interview, we had the chance to talk with the world-known historian Adam Tooze. We have touched issues such as the upcoming presidential election in the US, the economic platform of each of the presidential candidates, and of course about the recently published Mario Draghi report and its possible impact on the future of the European Union. If you are new to our channel, please consider to subscribe. Let's roll. There is an apparent contradiction in the current US presidential election campaign. On one hand, the different polls and prediction models show an extremely tight and unpredictable race between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris. On the other hand, when we look at elite endorsements, the picture is much more skewed in favor of Harris. There is a broader coalition behind her, ranging from left wing of Democratic Party to important parts of the former Republican establishment, like the Cheneys or former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. How do you make sense of this situation?
I mean, I completely recognize the picture that you're painting, and this is what drives, you know, folks who think of themselves maybe as sort of at the center of American politics a little bit crazy, because there is this huge gap, and it's not surprising. You see the same thing, say, in Wall Street, where corporate Wall Street is massively skewed against Donald Trump for reasons which are not puzzling, right? You wouldn't, if you're the manager of a large business, want to be associated with somebody as erratic, as wild, and who's a convicted felon. And yet, the polling in the critical states, and the most critical of all is Pennsylvania, and it's just too tight to call, is completely indecisive. And it fundamentally, what this points to is a structural gap between the American elite, very broadly conceived, and the electorate. Who still, at least as far as the polling suggests, and generally speaking, the polling underestimates support for Trump, doggedly remain attached to this extraordinarily eccentric, one has to say at this point, erratic figure who evokes a very different analysis of the American president that suggests the possibility of a radically different future. And yet, can anyone really believe that? I mean, either he's serious in his diagnosis, this utterly gothic account of American reality that he presents, which doesn't, as we know, sociologically reflect the reality of his voters, who don't come from the most impoverished and distressed parts of the American society. The most poor and distressed people tend not to vote at all and are barely touched by the political system. And those that do support him belong, you know, classically to something you would generally describe as the petty bourgeoisie, or the, you know, the upper levels of the white labor aristocracy. So, no, it's a very, very puzzling situation, amplified by the extraordinarily erratic nature of the 18th century American Constitution, which is at work here. So it's a very strange melange of a kind of post-truth, post-reality political system on the one hand, with 21st century realities, the singular figure of Donald Trump, and what one's almost tempted to describe as a kind of, you know, reality TV version of politics, which is what he's acting out, or the analogy was widely used during the first presidency, I liked it as well, to wrestling, you know, to this bizarre, tongue-in-cheek, not entirely serious, and yet deadly serious, you know, version of politics as combat. It is a deeply confusing situation in the American political scene right now. And, you know, I finished both my recent books on contemporary history puzzling over the crisis of American power and American hegemony, and it goes very deep, I think. And 4 years of something like normality under Biden should not disguise from us how profound that destabilization continues to be.
Coming back to that normality, I want to ask you about another similar contradiction. The economic record of Joe Biden is generally praised by economic policy analysts, while U.S. voters are less content with it. So how do you evaluate Bidenomics, and how do you explain this discrepancy between expert and popular opinion?
So one line to go with is to extend the argument I've just made about the political scene, you know, per se, which is to say that the evaluation of the American economy is not separate from people's evaluation of political reality generally, and the two things are sort of merged with each other. And if you look at sentiment polling, so these polls about how people judge their own political values, there is strong evidence for this mutual determination of political attitude and economic assessment. So the day after an election which goes against their favored party, Americans' assessment of their own immediate economic situation darkens, right? And when they lose, their assessment of their economic situation collapses, and when they win, it pops up. And so assessments of economic reality in America are partisan political at their core. That's one way of reading this, in which case one simply says, what do you expect? Biden is a relatively unpopular, in fact, he's the most unpopular Democratic president, since records began, essentially. And so he can do as well as he likes on the macro side without it fundamentally shifting views. Another way of reading this is that the macro perspective is missing something. It's missing something important at level of the experience reality of sections of American society with a particular series of problems. And if you look at the swing states, their economic record is really mixed. So a state like Pennsylvania, which is the decisive one, has had relatively slow growth since 2019. It is a state with chronic problems of poverty, both in the hinterland, the rural areas, and in the inner cities of Pennsylvania. These are cities like Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Harrisburg. And so, you know, there is a sort of lingering problem there of underperformance, which is real, a little bit like, say, the sort of voting patterns we see in parts of Poland, where you look at Poland's overall economic growth and you say, why on earth are these people not delightedly in love with the European Union? Mm-hmm. And then you look at the eastern parts of Poland and all of a sudden you discover that they aren't really doing that well. So that's one element. Another argument like this is the cost of living argument, where again, I think there is and I would say this as somebody who lives in the United States, there's a vast difference between the experienced reality of buying groceries in the US and the cost of living index published by the Fed. And it's, you know, I'm a technocratically minded person, so I don't say this lightly, but there's something wrong with those numbers, or they just don't capture the reality, because this has become an incredibly expensive place to live in. And It's a weird experience for me, because I've written about the history of statistics, so I know how these things are made up, and there's something very strange going on there. And where this really bites is the cost of living as measured by housing costs. And so these obviously can be an effect of economic growth. So even if you do have a good economic record, if you're not building enough new housing, and this is now a real obsession of the Democratic Party, if you're not able to actually expand the supply side in the face of running the economy hot, which has been the mantra of progressive economic policy, you get full employment, which is great, and particularly good at the bottom end of the labor market, and there's been a narrowing of inequality. It's not just the GDP numbers look good, but the inequality numbers in America have, you know, it's been a huge increase in the bargaining power, it seems, of lower-waged Americans. But the problem is the cost of living is getting more and more expensive. And so that's, you know, that bites. So those are the two, I think, prevalent explanations for this jarring disparity.
One central theme in most of your work is trying to understand economic policy, not as abstract ideas, but as attempts by politicians to assemble, let's say, different segments of the business elites and the larger public into stable coalitions. In this perspective, how do you situate the Harris and Trump projects?
So on the Harris side, I think we see an extension of the Democratic Party's effort since Obama to reposition itself. So if you think of the coalition that Obama inherited from the Clinton era, it was the 90s coalition, and this was a coalition centered on liberal Wall Street, right? So it came via Rubin, the Treasury Secretary under Obama, who was ex-Goldman Sachs CEO. Then there was, and this translated across parties, so Hank Paulson, Bush's Treasury Secretary, was also a Goldman Sachs CEO. It got to the point when Tim Geithner, who was a Rubin acolyte, became Treasury Secretary under Obama, that everyone imagined that he had a Goldman Sachs track record, and he never did. He was actually a civil servant all his life, but everyone just looked at him and said, he's an investment banker, but he wasn't. And so that, I think, was a caricature of the degree to which investment banking, which is the more adventurous, more globally orientated wing of American banking, had become a symbol for the de facto elite that was governing America. And that has fragmented since 2008 in various different ways. And I see the Democrats as trying to corral a new coalition, which is broadly a kind of green modernizing growth coalition, which includes liberal finance. So if you'd like, it would be more Larry Fink of BlackRock, which is the great fund manager. It's an asset manager, it's not a bank. It would be tech, which is what Harris brings in a really big way and began to open up with Obama. And it would be various types of green energy interest, Duke, for instance, in the South, that was very important in pushing for the Inflation Reduction Act to actually happen. So I would see that as their coalition, with then an associated college-educated female electorate that fits neatly with that. There was an effort from the left to include in that coalition the actual American working class, which is diverse, service sector orientated. That didn't prove possible, in part because of contradictions within the Democratic Party's own camps. And that would be because Manchin was running a much more conservative blue-collar line and killed Build Back Better. So that's the confines of the Democratic side. The Trump coalition is much more eclectic. And it includes fossil fuel. It's quite clear that he's making a serious bid for fossil fuel. Yes. But then around that, he has this cluster of oligarchic money. And the interesting thing about oligarchic money is that it's only in rare exceptions systemically relevant, right? It's in the US economy, which is a $25 trillion economy, a mere billionaire is not really a big player. And if you don't have a multi-trillion dollar balance sheet like JP Morgan or BlackRock, you're not really a big player in the system. But if you are a hedge fund manager with, billions in personal assets, or a tech tycoon of the middle tier, not the Alphabets and the Googles, right, but the Palantirs, the mid-tier of Silicon Valley, they have huge resources. An American election's expensive, but it costs $2 billion, right? So from the point of view of a multi-billionaire, this is not really an expensive undertaking. To buy influence with an American politician costs you hundreds of millions at the very most, right? So this is small change for them. And all you need is to be one of those kind of players, and you're in. And the thing about that kind of capital is it's not constrained by law, by human resource departments, by the conventional standards of American polite society. It can be whatever Elon Musk decides on any given day, right? Or whatever Thiel or whoever else is calling the shot has decided is his latest intellectual hobby. And so it's very difficult to predict or really provide structural explanation, because it could just be some dude who got rich with some payment software in the early 2000s who wakes up one morning and goes, what else am I going to spend a couple of hundred million on this year? Yeah. Let's do this. And it's not, it's kind of an erratic element in power, because the US economy as such is too big to be run by people like this. And the people who run the American economy in the macro sense tend to be demo-aligned, because they have to abide by the law, right? Like J.B. Diamond once said, you need a shrink and a lawyer to run J.P. Morgan. And like, Trump doesn't like really dealing with either shrinks or lawyers, for obvious reasons, because he's mad and bad. So the only reason he employs them is to ward off, standard mainstream America trying to regulate him. So it's a very erratic coalition. The one theory I really like is the petty bourgeois gentry theory of Trump. So And again, this is like differentiating our understanding of wealth and power. Because if you look at the top 1% of American society, most of those people are not hedge fund managers or, you know, Wall Street barons. Most of them own car dealerships, big construction, you know, medium-sized regional construction firms. They run chains of franchised fast food businesses. These people are worth $20 to $30 million. And they are what one sociologist labeled them, the American gentry. Mm-hmm. And that group is overwhelmingly Trump. Because why? Because they depend on low taxes and light regulation for their businesses to make the huge profits that they do. And so that, if you like, is the kind of, if you're looking for a thick sociological glue, as opposed to just the vapors that drive the billionaire backers of Trump, that would be the group I would look at. Fossil fuel, obviously, because they are worried about the green thing. And then this core group of businesses that do Republican clientelistic politics at the state and the national level to secure the licensing, to secure the regulation or the lack of regulation and the tax deals and the standoff on illegal migrant labor that allows them to tick along. Migrant labor is, for that group, actually a really difficult issue. And this is where you have to say Trump is not a rational, he's not a rational player in this system, because if he was serious about trying to coalesce that group, he would be, you know, lackadaisical on migrant labor instead of threatening these mass deportations.
You've mentioned Peter Thiel, Elon Musk. Yeah. What is your explanation about why they are mostly Trump-leaning? So, you know, culturally, these guys in the Silicon Valley were absolutely, so they have, you know, Democratic affiliations, but right now they are hardcore Trump supporters. So what is your explanation for such a phenomenon?
I mean, you know, you don't want to try too hard to explain somebody like Elon Musk. Thiel, because he's just a very, very idiosyncratic individual. Vanity plays a huge role. In Thiel's case, he is a more concerted and serious-minded conservative thinker, I think. And I think they see, and Trump, of course, isn't. So why are they backing him? Because I think they see him as a wrecking ball. They see Trump as a bulldozer. They see Trump as somebody who'll break down convention. They're quite profoundly convinced that America is in crisis. And so a little bit like, you know, in a, I don't know, a slow-moving billiard game, or, you know, somebody at some point just fires the ball into the pack of balls and they fly everywhere, and then you look for opportunity in that space. And I think they're starting from that kind of position. They have a deep-seated analysis of American crisis, and they believe that the Democrats, their besetting sin, and they're not wrong about this after all, is their vanity. And, you know, the gerontocracy within the Democratic Party is profound. And this is because the baby boomers really have an incredibly hard time admitting that it's no longer their game to play. This is symptomatic of the broader crisis they diagnosed. And so they want to do anything, really, I think, to shatter that. They reckon probably that they'll get more military spending than they would under the Dems, though it's hard to see how you could be more aggressive in foreign policy than the Biden team have been. But above all, of course, they also reckon with the fact that there won't be obnoxious taxes, right? They really, really don't like the proposed tax on unrealized capital gains. That, for their model of business, would be expensive, and they really dislike that. What's interesting, though, is once upon a time you would have said they also don't like aggressive regulation of the tech space. And that's not true, because Thiel and Musk, both of them, are in what's called the mid-tech space, right? So there are the startups, and then there are the mega players, the Googles, the Alphabets, of this world. And the mid-techs actually are now in an essentially aligned with various types of antitrust measure to try and break up the grip that the big players, you know, Amazon, Facebook, Google, have on the tech sphere, which they regard as oppressive. And they see, again, the alliance between those groups and the Democratic Party, which is quite strong, as symptomatic of this American establishment that needs breaking up. There is at that level quite a profound, you know, this is part of a populist impulse, after all, to imagine that the world is structured around a set of incumbent power elites that need challenging. And it's often a, it's a, you know, as we say, like it's a stupid person's leftism. Like it's not wrong in its diagnosis of power. Mm-hmm. There is a power structure, there is inequality. It's just incredibly crude in understanding how that works.
Hmm. Unfortunately, our time is brief, so let's turn our attention to Europe. I would like to ask you about the Mario Draghi report. So the former European Central Bank chief recently has published his much-awaited report on EU competitiveness. The report calls for much higher levels of investment in the economy and for a much more integrated European Union. But the first is blocked by Germany's masochistic attachment to fiscal discipline, while the latter by the visible rise of parties opposing further integration. What are the prospects for the emergence of a political coalition capable of carrying out the necessary steps despite these oppositions?
Well, in terms of our previous analysis of the US, I would also say that Mario Draghi, true to form, and this is perhaps his historic role ultimately, I think he has a historic role in the Italian context, but he also has one at the EU level, is that he's saying out loud what, you know, large parts of the European business elite clearly believe, which is that as a platform for capitalist accumulation, because we shouldn't dress this up as national competitiveness, right? He's saying as a platform for capitalist accumulation, the EU has not worked as well as the United States for the last decades, right? Yeah. It's really striking reading it from an American vantage point, because the Americans also think their platform's not working, and then the Europeans look at it and go, oh, no, it's working great. You've no idea how good you've got it. What America gives its big businesses is lax antitrust regulation. So they get really big, they have monopolistic grip on markets, then they make huge profits. So then they reinvest and they drive technology, and they're backed up by a very powerful military industrial complex, which spends a significant amount of money on American power. And that runs by way of a cluster of large contractors to the American armament system. And Draghi's basically saying, we need all of that. We need a dose of oligopoly. We need a dose of state capitalism in Europe that works better. And you could say that that was, after all, his message when he was running the European Central Bank, was that we actually needed a monetary system that backed up European finance capital. And it wasn't doing that effectively because it was in the lock grip of various petty bourgeois ideologies of austerity that actually don't work for big capital. And now he's saying the same thing about industrial policy. So that's how I would see it. What's fascinating is the Germans blocked it two ways immediately, right? One, they said no fiscal, and then B, they said UniCredit can't buy Commerzbank. Whereas the UniCredit boss is exactly Draghi's kind of capitalist. The UniCredit boss is saying we need to unify and create capable European banks capable of standing up to the global competition. And so that's, I think, Draghi has pointed his finger at what many of us now diagnose as the central difference. From the point of view of European voters and consumers, at least over the medium term, it's not obvious that the Draghi prescription is a good one, because he literally says Europeans should pay more like what Americans pay for their cell phones. And as an American cell phone subscriber, I don't recommend it as a model. Depends what time horizon you're looking at and what time horizon we're discussing the technological options over. I would like a much more public sector heavy version of the Draghi report. I think Draghi leaves that fundamentally open. So to answer your question, I'm skeptical about its chances of being translated into powerful policy because of the impasse in Germany. If Berlin got behind it, This is red meat for Paris. This is red meat for Rome. Madrid would do it as well. But if Berlin is obstructing the way it is, it's difficult to see any constructive movement at the macro level in Europe.
So I'm coming from a country that is betting heavily on Chinese battery and the EV industry. CATL and other Chinese battery manufacturers, plus the BYD, are all investing in Hungary heavily. And according to analysts, the Hungarian government wishes to become a meeting point for the German and Chinese actors of the EV supply chain. Do you think such a strategy could work, given the contradictory European drive to reduce dependence on Chinese green infrastructure?
I mean, I don't say this lightly, speaking to you in Hungary. but it seems to me at the very least a rational strategy. It's an impressively coherent vision for a player like Hungary, because you are in a hugely exposed position in the internal combustion engine chain. The reality, I think, for the future of the European motor vehicle industry is that it either cooperates and finds options for synergistic cooperation with the Chinese, or its future is very bleak indeed. And the reality is that has to work along the lines that Hungary is experimenting with. And I don't think it's an irrational strategy. It grieves me to say this because of the source of the strategy and the leadership that it backs. But I actually think it's far-sighted to be making those moves. The Americans can make the power plays on Europe and China that they do in large part because they don't have the exposure that the European motor vehicle industry does to China anymore, and specifically the German industry does. And Hungary is in an incredibly vulnerable position in this transition, and to get on the front foot in this respect makes perfect sense. So, and I think from, you know, since I'm somebody that really for whom the rank order of priorities starts with the climate crisis and the energy transition, a compromise with the Chinese regime on these key technologies is essential. There's no way around it. If you've spent any time recently in China, you know how far ahead of the West they are in the in this crucial area of the transition. And so we need all of that reverse foreign direct investment from the Chinese. We say we need joint ventures with the Chinese. We need to basically be orientating ourselves to acquiring their technology rather than the other way around.
And also, so Hungary is facing some serious economic problems right now. The government is having trouble keeping the deficit under control. The inflation has subsided, but was one of the highest in the EU, while growth rates are also lower than in the 2010s. In this context, there is a fight between the head of the central bank, Mr. György Matolcsy, who argues for monetary and fiscal discipline, while the Minister of Economy, Márton Nagy, is proponent of the so-called high-pressure economy and of the government intervening heavily to attract foreign investment. Theoretically, what is your position on this approach of generating economic growth? And if not this, then what can work by your understanding for such a small and economically open country as Hungary?
I have no wiggle room on this. I have no wiggle room. I'm a high growth, run the economy hot, take monetary risks person all the way down the line. I always have been, and not suddenly because we're talking about Hungary going to flip that position from an economic point of view. My view about this kind of economics has always been that it is politically indeterminate, right? This is always one of the weak spots of a Keynesian economics, or rather it's an aspect of the Keynesian economics which forces you to combine it with the politics, right? By itself, it's politically open-ended. You know, the Nazi regime operated a highly effective macroeconomic policy from 1933 onwards in the service of massive rearmament fundamentally, right?
Yeah, and you wrote an entire book about that.
Yes, I did. And there's no way of escaping that. And Keynes was honest enough to admit that this was indeed a highly sophisticated implementation of modern economic policy. So very disagreeable regimes can occupy very constructive policy spaces. And one of my great anxieties about Europe for many years now has been that a sort of liberalism and pro-European policies, progressive politics, get married to profoundly self-harming economics. And in part because of a game of my enemy's enemy is my friend, right? So if a policy of a national populist regime is adopting a Keynesian policy, then by definition, everyone who opposes that regime must therefore espouse a austere liberal policy as its antidote. And this is a catastrophe to be backed into that kind of corner. The problem, of course, is if you don't have power, it's the other side that gains the benefits of a more dynamic and more positive and more proactive policy, which also gives people the sense of agency, which is clearly one of the key things which is lacking in the current moment. And so what terrifies me about the broader EU, to speak there, is that we have this self-reinforcing, perverse, vicious cycle. We're seeing it played out in Germany, where a progressive coalition, one I hailed as the most progressive in the world, which I think was a fair assessment of the time it was formed, has essentially self-obstructed to the point at which very reasonable voters are saying, we actually need somebody to do something in Germany, and so the first thing I need to do is wake those bastards up in Berlin. And how do I do that? Well, I make a really radical political choice that will get their attention. And it's, you know, it's bad politics in every respect, but you can understand where that motivation comes from. So I think right now the evidence is that, you know, take Turkey, for instance, you can run an economy in the current global space, which has productive resource and is close to the EU. You can run it appallingly badly and get away with it. Hmm. So my sense is that, unfortunately, if you like, there are no liberal guardrails which are going to swoop in. This was the same with Brexit, right? And the divine judgment of the market will deliver punishment to the absurd exponents of Brexit in the UK. It never happened, right? That is the liberal conceit. The markets are too baggy and too flexible right now. And so for progressive opinion in Hungary, I would think this is one of the really great dilemmas, is you can't invoke that external constraint in a reasonable way and say, well, therefore we must pursue a, you know, tight ship. And, you know, this kind of line, I think, is a dead end.
You have written books about the political economy of both the First and the Second World War. And so I'm really interested, what do you think about the performance of the Russian and Ukrainian economies in the current war?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, you've got to get scale, right? Like, yeah. The Russian economy is like 10 times the size of the Ukrainian economy, right? So it's like, we're not talking, is it really 10? Anyway, it's huge. And whenever I say that, I think that can't be right. But it's a vast disparity, right? Both have survived. Both demonstrate the ability of competent national economic government to manage a really devastating, very serious crisis. In the Russian case, my read is somewhat perversely that the war has jobbed them out of a very conservative mindset that prevailed really as a legacy of the late 1919 crisis in Russia, right? Putin and his cohorts learned the lesson that you build stability by fiscal conservatism. They run government surpluses, they have a big sovereign wealth fund, they run huge export surpluses, they accumulate reserves. This was the kind of conservative war chest strategy. And it served them quite well when they were doing small challenges to the global order, Georgia, Ukraine won. But of course, all their reserves were just sanctioned when it came to the real struggle. But the upside is that it's unleashed the policy imagination in Moscow. So all of a sudden now you essentially have a much more aggressively nationalistic industrial policy, which has compensated for the loss of external markets by domestic demand. And as a result, the home front in Russia is holding up really rather well, because in a sense, the old regime in which Russia bid for fiscal and financial respectability by an internal conservatism was self-harming, right? It restrained Russia's growth, it limited investment, it actually made the Russian economy more and more dependent on oil and gas as its major sources of external demand. So in a weird way, sanctions are a salutary shock to the Russian policymaking system, which has pushed them more towards an aggressive, assertive national Keynesian strategy, which works quite well, for at least for a while, right? Is it a long-run strategy? No, but that's in the long run, we're all dead. The whole point is what happens in the near future. Ukraine looked like it was going off the rails. What we've learned in Ukraine is that with sufficient external support and competent and relatively disciplined internal management, right? There was a big struggle there too between the war-fighting part of the government and the central bank, and there was a compromise clearly. It hasn't been documented in great detail, but there was a compromise done at the end of the first year in which the West committed enough external support and the Ukrainians agreed no longer to use domestic monetary financing, and that has enabled them to stabilize the economy. It's very fragile, though, and I think it's really underestimated. And as we all know, it's a problems not just from the monetary macro balance, but from the supply side that are really worrying. And in the coming winter, it'll be the electricity supply that's crucial, right? If the Russians are actually able to drive home their narrow sustained attack on Ukraine's infrastructure, the first year of that, the Ukrainians had enough reserve capacity to cope, but I think they no longer do. As far as I understand it, they're basically down to the nuclear reactors at this point. And if the Russians can hit the transformer stations around those, it's really not clear whether the Ukrainians can sustain the power supply. And as important for an economy as the monetary system is the electricity supply system. So these are the, you know, these are one or two of the common denominators of any modern economy. And if you can knock the electricity supply system out, you just, you will get, you know, non-linear, very, very serious interruptions to production that will devastate the Ukrainian home front. So I think that's the financial balance is just about holding. A Trump administration would make that problematic, but they've tried to Trump-proof aid. The Europeans could come up with more money if they needed to. But the supply side is a different story. And the manpower issue as well, of course, but that's really more strictly a military matter and a political balance the Ukrainians have to strike as to whether or not. De facto, neither side is fighting this as a total war. It's a very interesting example of a modern war to speak, you know, rather coldly about what is obviously a ghastly human drama. But it's an extraordinary instance of two sides, neither of which are really operating at total war, even though the stakes for both sides are existential.
Professor Tuz, I would have multiple additional questions, but unfortunately our time's up. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you very much for the chance for raising these questions. I hope we can talk to each other soon and maybe we will have a second interview, maybe after the election or maybe next year. So thank you very much for your time and thank you very much for your insight on these issues.
Very happy. Look forward to our next talk.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.